Hey folks, we've got a new workshop coming up that I'm really excited about. This is a topic that I don't talk about a whole lot on the show. This is September 23rd at noon, and this is going to be about debt. I find a lot of the teaching on this particular topic is not so great. It's very one-sided, or it misses a lot of detail that I think really needs to be addressed. You know, how do we get into it? We talk about that a little bit, but there, you know, some people say, well, you'd get into it because of lack of discipline. Well, no, it often is more nuanced than that. We're going to be talking about how do you get out of it? How do we change our mindset regarding it in lots of different ways? Some of the best advice I was ever given was like over 30 years ago that helped me a lot. And I'm going to share some of that in the workshop. And we're going to talk about the little known facts and myths about credit scores. A lot of people don't understand how credit scores work. So I'm going to get into that. And people ask about, now, Paul, what about 30 versus 15-year mortgages? And people think you always do one or the other. And that's more nuanced as well. And I'm going to be talking about strategically when to use one versus another and some of the thinking regarding that. So it's going to be a great workshop. I'm really excited about it. September 23rd at noon. Join us, and you can click in the show notes to sign up or go to paulwinkler.com/debt. We'll see you there.
Welcome to the Investor Coaching Show, a podcast to help you get an insider's view of the financial world and escape common investment traps. We look at the financial news of the day and help you make sense of it so you can relax about money. And here's your host, Paul Winkler.
Yeah, there it is. Okay, there's one article. There it is. 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 So it was... I think it was this one. Was it this one? Yeah, it was this one. It was the one you guys, I don't know, we usually check out the Wall Street Journal, and a lot of times Jason Zweig has some good stuff in there. What you've lost in this bull market. I remember seeing something this week, and I knew I was going to talk about it. So I had a question for the show, and the question was, Paul, the P.E. ratio for the S&P 500 is around 38-1. Historically, the average P/E ratio is only 16-1. In the last decade, the average has been closer to 19-1. Regardless, by either of these measures, the stock market's overvalued by two standard deviations above the mean. What's your take on the value of the stock market as a whole? Was the question Jim asked.
That must have been a Cool Springs client.
Oh, he's a very sharp guy. I'm going to tell you, he's a very sharp guy.
We have yes. Sharp clients down here.
So, Jim, now you know what I think of you. Okay. Okay. So, number one, when you're looking at P/E ratios, you have forward P/E ratios, and then you have backward looking. And when you're looking at 38-1, you're looking at backward looking. So, in essence, we came out of a year of dismal economic outcomes. So, therefore, the earnings were extremely low. And because the stock market is a forward-looking economic indicator, it's looking out 2 years, 3 years into the future, what'll happen when earnings are extremely low? So let's say that it's normally a 16-1, just so that I give you an idea of this. Now, when you have income coming in, sales, money coming in the door, minus expenses, if the economy goes downhill in a really, really rapid fashion, then your sales go way down really fast, but your expenses don't necessarily go down. And then your earnings go down triply fast. I mean, very, very rapidly. So let's say that your earnings, it's $16 that you normally pay for every dollar of earnings. And all of a sudden your earnings drop down to 25 cents. Okay. Because it's really bad. Well, let's not make it quite that bad. I mean, let's make it, they go down to 50 cents. Okay. If that happens, then basically your PE ratio is 32-1 because it's 16.5 if the price is sitting at, and that's exactly what's going on, is the price has been maintained. The stock market actually maintained last year. It didn't go down. It actually went up, the S&P 500, that is. So if the earnings went down to half of what they were because of a rapid drop in sales, without the commensurate drop in expenses, then what will happen is your P/E ratio will be 32-1 or 16.5. Okay, so I hope that makes some sense right there. So when we look at it and we go, oh my goodness, the stock market's wildly overvalued. Remember, when you're looking at that 38-1, you're looking at the past year. What I would rather look at, and I rather do look at, is forward earnings over the next coming year. But that even limits us to a great extent because it doesn't include growth in earnings. Is the problem that we run into. It doesn't include the growth in earnings because if we look at it, we go, oh my goodness, we're going into another season. COVID could be company slowdowns for a little while and blah, 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 and all of that. And now we could have a situation where the earnings growth rate isn't so great right now, but it could be very, very rapid after we come out of all of this, right? And that's what a lot of people are looking at is maybe there are supply chains right now that are held up because chip suppliers aren't getting the chips out there or whatever. So there are a lot of reasons that we could have a PE ratio that looks like it's a little bit high. Now, yes, the S&P 500 is much higher than any other market. But one of the things you got to realize is that in a well-diversified portfolio, if you're following the philosophy that I teach here, which is overemphasize smaller, overemphasize value in an investment portfolio, it's going to be a minority of your portfolio anyway. It's not going to be the biggest part of your portfolio. It doesn't mean that, you know, we don't have any of it. We would want to have some of it, but we wouldn't be focusing on it because of 96% of the time value stocks outperform growth and 83% of 20-year periods small companies outperform large. So what does that have to do with this article from Jason Zweig? Well, this article, and Ira, I'm sure you're going to have some input on this because you probably dealt with this more on the brokerage end where you came from the wirehouse. But Jason Zweig is saying, well, what we've lost in this bull market. And this guy he says, well, you can't invest at all without taking risk. And if you keep 100% of your money in treasury bills backed by the U.S. government, Uncle Sam, you run the very real risk that with today's paltry interest rates, the income you earn won't maintain purchasing power. Net of inflation, you're highly likely to lose money. So he jumps over to this guy that was apparently, he was an accountant his entire working life, loves numbers, loves spreadsheets. Guy's 69 years old, lives in Dallas, Fort Worth. He's been trading full-time since late January. At one point, what he did is he set up an account using about $200,000 in margin.
Ooh.
Yeah. Now, did you guys see a lot of that when you were in the wire?
There were a lot of guys who did trade on margin. I never traded on margin. I just never really thought it beneficial. I knew that the people who lost all their money during the Depression were those people who traded on margin.
Right.
So I always said, Paul, you buy what you can afford to buy, and that's it. Yeah. You don't need to leverage yourself anymore.
Well, and a lot of people did that just to try to increase the returns because, you know, you pay back a couple percent interest and you make 50% on your money and you're only paying back a couple percent interest, you're like, yeah, man, but yeah, it works against you if it goes the other direction.
Well, it's one of those things that the PIMCO Total Return Fund does. They actually buy a lot of bonds on margin. And if we see a big increase in interest rates, that fund's going to get hammered.
Oh, I remember they had a negative cash position. You know, I haven't looked at them in years. Have you?
Because it's
margin. Are they still?
No, but I can look it up.
I haven't looked at it in years. Bill Gross used to be run that, but Bill Gross kind of fell on hard times. There was an article about him the other day.
Well, he had like a bad, I don't even remember if it was marriage or just a bad investment call is why he got
I don't remember what it was, but I remember seeing something the other day that things weren't going so well.
Thinking about PIMCO was one where I like questioned what was going on with my software, you know, because you're used to seeing a particular diagram of how much is cash and how much is bonds. Like, wait a minute. What? This is like negative 83%. Yeah, we have negative 83%.
No, you're right. It was a negative cash position. People would ask me about that and go, well, that's what they call margin. You know, because what you're doing, you're betting on the direction of interest rates. You're betting that interest rates are going to actually go, what you were expecting is that, you know, that they would go down, the bond prices would go up, and you would actually get a bump in that. But if you bet the wrong direction, you're sunk, man. If the interest rates actually went up instead of down, then you've got to cover that because you've borrowed the money betting on a certain direction and it doesn't go that way. Well, so this guy, what he does all this stuff on margin, and you know, you can like borrow like half the purchase price, you know, so you can go in, if you're going to buy stock, you can take $2,000 of your money, and then you can borrow another $2,000 and buy $4,000 of the stock. That's the idea behind margin. And that's why it's so dangerous, because if it goes the other direction, you buy $4,000 of stock and it goes down to $1,000, you owe $2,000 and you lost $1,000 of your own.
And you have to have the money in the brokerage firm by 4 p.m. Eastern time that day. Otherwise, they sell out.
Margin call,
to cover the margin call.
Yeah, that's brutal. Exactly, Ira. Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, you have a margin call and they decide to sell you. You're like, no, I know this stock's going to go up. We don't care.
Yeah.
What you think it's going to do, it didn't do what you thought it was going to do, and you must, and they'll sell it out from under you. Yeah, exactly. You don't get that
choice.
And
charge you for doing it.
Yeah, so this guy basically, he had $200,000 in margin, you know, borrowed money. And he buys 160 stocks, and he goes, oh, this is ridiculous. I have too many stocks. No, you can't make this stuff up. So he goes down to 96 holdings, right? And he says, but I can't seem to stop. He says, I'll just load up, and I make a killing tomorrow. And, you know, I hope it's going to go back up. And he says, no, next day it went down. Another 17%.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. And he says... And the thing is here we are in this raging bull market, $200,000 in margin, and he makes $18,000. And I'm looking at it going, well, what if I just went and, you know, what if I just took $200,000 and I just didn't even borrow the money, and what if I had invested it? You know, what would my gain be? And in just about in literally every asset category.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the lower asset categories was large U.S. stocks, but just about every asset category, you look at it and go, well, you know, in reality, $200,000 in small value stocks would have been up $62,000 over that period of time versus the 20. And then you got, you know, large U.S. stocks up 44,000, and then that was the lower performing of the U.S. asset categories.
Right.
U.S. microcap companies about up 54,000 is what the gain would have been. 50,000 for small companies and 44,000 for large value. In every case, even though he used margin, which is supposed to magnify your gains.
Okay, so the PIMCO Total Return Fund.
Yeah.
Minus 17.6% in cash.
Okay, so they're still doing that then. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And they have underperformed their asset category. Well, $10,000 ending, where is this date here?
Well, that's interesting.
Ending August 15th.
Okay. For
the category. For 10 years,
the
category averaged $15,135. It grew to. Where that fund grew to $14,471.
Yeah.
So you have to wonder what the interest that they're paying on the margin is.
Well, I think just in general, here is a fund that we saw in virtually every 401k.
Yes.
Correct.
I would say 10 years ago.
And
I see it today.
Yeah, I still see it.
Do you still see it?
Yeah.
Seriously?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So... I look at that and go, okay, this is a fund that is still in so many. But, you know, 10 years ago, it was everywhere. And here we go, this great underperformance. And I remember telling my clients, you know, when I would look at this, I'd go, this is your only bond choice, and I think we ought to punt. You know, if this is your only bond choice, you've got it. And
can
I would
use the fixed account. Yeah.
I would use the fixed account. That's
right.
Exactly what I would do. And that is usually I will not do that.
Right.
And the reason I would want bonds, longer bonds, is because when stock markets come crumbling down, your bonds, your longer term bonds, tend to shoot the other direction, whereas cash just pays whatever interest rate it's going to pay. So if you got $100,000 in a bond fund and you have a year like 2002, well, at the end of the year, at least the bond portion of the portfolio is at $116,000 because those intermediate bonds were up 16%. And, you know, in reality, well, what's your cash going to do? Well, you're going to have $101,000 at the end of the year. So if I have a portfolio that I have all these different asset categories in and stocks go down, I would like to have something that goes up more than just the 1% that the short-term bonds are paying or the really short cash type things. And PIMCO, I would look at that and go, I'm not willing to bet that's not going to go straight down with the stock market.
Yeah.
You know?
It didn't sound like in the article that the guy had learned his lesson, though.
No, I doubt it.
It didn't sound like at the end, and I threw in my towel, and I'm just going to, you know, let the market do its thing. It sounds like he's still going to just keep beating his head against the wall on margin trying to beat the market.
Well, I think that is very, very much the case. And he was just talking about, you know, he did say, if I had just parked money in some index funds, I probably would have done better than I have done, with a rueful laugh, he says. It's probably may not be a good way to invest, maybe, but it has become my life, is literally what he said. I mean, that is, it's an addictive thing. It's an addictive behavior. And back to Jim's question, if you look at the S&P 500, if you look at large U.S. stocks, those companies are selling for $4.43, according to Morningstar, for every dollar of book value. And that is higher than historically normal. And he's looking at P/E ratio. And by the way, Jim, I typically look more at your price to book to give me an idea, because P/E ratio can fool you because of those earnings growth rates that I was talking about, or lack of earnings.
Way more volatile. Yeah.
It's a lot more volatile. It's much more difficult to look at.
So that guy in that article is dealing with overconfidence bias.
Oh, yeah. No question about it. I am bulletproof. I'm an accountant. I know this stuff. And I know numbers. And the reality of it is, yeah, you may be very, very smart. So just back to real quick regarding large U.S. stocks, S&P, like I said, it's going to be a smaller part of the portfolio. I wouldn't overemphasize it. If you look at other areas of the market right now, you got small value stocks are only selling for like $1.29 for every dollar book value. Microcaps about $1.98 right now, according to Morningstar. International small companies, they're about $1.37. International small value, 83 cents, way lower than the $4.43 for large U.S. stocks. And you know, emerging markets, if you look at those areas, international large value at like 99 cents for every dollar book value. So what's the key here? The key is make sure you don't have all your money in that just one area. And I'm not saying it's overvalued, the S&P 500, but I am telling you, yeah, you're right. It's not a bargain on the table waiting to be picked up, but you can explain why the number is so significantly higher than what it normally is. It makes some sense when you understand why P/E ratios can be so, so misleading. All right. Let's change gears now. Hey, you know what? We're on this roll. Hey, if you had a question for the show, paulwinkler.com/question is, if you wondered how that last person asked a question, that's how they do it. paulwinkler.com/question. And what we do is we'll answer that right here on the show and then shoot you a copy of the segment so you don't miss your question being answered. Paul, here he asks, I have a 401 at work. Also have an individual IRA. I'll let you guys, why don't you guys take this? Okay. Can I move into a 401k, my 401k into my IRA that I already have, or do I have to set up a new IRA? Most important, will the transfer be made non-taxable since I will move directly from a 401 to an IRA? I want to then do a QCD out of my IRA since I'll be 72 next year. All right.
So the answer is yes and yes. You can move it into the IRA.
Yep.
And yes, no, it will not be taxable as long as it goes directly to the IRA.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you put it into a Roth IRA, then it'll be taxable, but there won't be any penalties.
And you got the QCD.
And there won't be any withholding.
And you got that QCD that you make sure you know to do QCDs.
It's one of my
people.
Faves.
Yeah, go ahead. Tell them what that is. Tell them what that is. Evan.
Qualified charitable distribution, and that actually starts at 70 and a half, even though your required minimum distributions start at 72 now. And yes, huge fan of QCDs. Mm-hmm. And you would want to make sure that you have your transfer completed. And I would at least get your first statement in a statement cycle just so that you know there's no problem with the reporting of the distribution on your 1099 from your IRA custodian, you know, for sure. Just make sure all the dust is settled before you process that.
I think it's a really good point, Evan. I'm glad you made that regarding that, because he did say 72, and I wasn't even thinking about that as I was reading it. But yeah, that was one of those things that stayed 70 and a half, being able to do the QCD. Right. Because the benefit of that is, for those of you who don't quite get what the benefit of that is you have required minimum distributions that have to come out. Now that age has been moved to age 72. It used to be 70 and a half. But the benefit is that most people aren't able to deduct charitable contributions because the standard deduction is so high. You know, because standard deduction is you either choose your regular deductible items like your property taxes, like your charitable contributions, like, you know, medical expenses and those types of things. And you either choose that or you choose the standard deduction. And for so many people, the standard deduction is so much higher. And if you do that, that means by definition, you don't get that charitable deduction. Well, you get that taxable income on the IRA distribution due to the required minimum distribution, and it would be nice to not have to pay taxes on it. Well, that's what you basically do. You have the check made out directly to the charity, and you can set it up, and it's kind of like getting your charitable deduction back. Beautiful thing. All right. Hey, this is Paul Winkler. Hope you enjoyed today's edition of the Investor Coaching Show. If you want to learn more about what we do, go to our website, paulwinkler.com. You can watch some of the videos there, and if you're not already a client, you can set up a free initial consultation. Until next time, I'm Paul Winkler, reminding you that I believe that more educated investors are more confident investors, and confident investors are more successful investors. Have a great one.